to give some lectures, a lecture on the fluctuation dissipation theorem. And you should all know, if you don't already know, that I'm a particle theorist. I'm not an experimentalist. This is way out of my level of expertise. So my goal with this lecture is to give people a kind of like apply as needed rules for the fluctuation dissipation theorem when someone is thinking about the noise budget of an experiment. Okay? So first question, who knows the fluctuation dissipation theorem? Who has studied before, even read it? Okay, Conrad, yes, you know. Okay, good. Okay, several people. Okay, then I'm in deep trouble. So first of all, some references. What's the chalk? Oh, here. So, and I'm short, so it won't go as high as other people today. Okay. So some references. So the original paper is by Cullen and Welton from 1951. I found that a very nice proof of it is summarized in and explained in Landau-Lipschitz. Volume 5, which is StatMech, Statistical Mechanics, paragraph 124, page 384. Okay? Perhaps I should write it here so that we don't. Paragraph 124, page 384. Okay? I also used, when preparing these notes, the book by Thorne and Blandford, Classical Modern Physics, Modern Classical Physics, sorry. There is a nice, this book is good in summarizing things and gives you some idea of the noise types you can have. Doesn't go much in depth. There are given that I'm going to be discussing the simple harmonic oscillator, I used a paper by Marcus Aspelmeyer, cavity optomechanics, and a very fun paper to read that I didn't know about before starting to prepare for these lectures. Is there is a science paper by Brzezinski, Vorontsov, and Thorne, Quantum Non-Demolition Measurements, QND measurements. And this is by Brzezinski, Thorne, and Vorontsov, sorry. So I didn't realize actually that the first papers on quantum non-demolition measurements were written by Kip Thorne in the context of resonant mass detectors for gravitational waves back in the late 70s. So first of all, so we start with a simple harmonic oscillator. And we're going to calculate the noise of the system. Now, there are two parts to this. So a simple harmonic oscillator can be a sensitive probe of a force. Now, there are two things when you have an experiment based on a simple harmonic oscillator. And it turns out there are standard, basically most of the experiments that we have are based on this idea. So, for example, David Moore, Giorgio Grata, Marcus talked about experiments based on essentially objects, maybe suspended by light, maybe by mechanical attachment, but in an essence is a simple harmonic oscillator. Conrad, for example, talks about another type of a simple harmonic oscillator, which is an RLC circuit. And I know how theorists feel about RLC circuits, so I won't talk about them. I will just mention them briefly. Now, so there are fundamental limitations that come from the detector, the abilities of the detector to detect something, okay? And for a harmonic oscillator, we are trying to detect a force. So that is what the fluctuation dissipation theorem addresses. And that I will try to address today. Now, there is another part that is the pain of the existence of every experimental is that systematics, okay, and backgrounds, as we call them, that I won't touch upon. I will assume I have the perfect experiment and say, if you have the perfect experiment, how well can you, in principle, do? Okay. So, simple harmonic oscillator. We have the position, so here is a wall, here is a spring, here is a mass, and this distance is x. There is a spring constant kappa, which is can be expressed in terms of the fundamental resonant frequency of the harmonic oscillator. And the equation of motion of the harmonic oscillator, as I hope everyone knows, is this under the influence of a force. So these are a function of time, dot is derivative over time. Now gamma determines the friction, it's the friction force, so determines the losses of the system. And there is another parameter that's relevant and many people talk about it, Q, which is the ratio of the resonant frequency over the loss factor. Oh, I should say another thing very important, H bar, given that I'm a theorist, particle theorist, H bar and C is one. And for the most purposes, that implies that also Boltzmann constant is one. Okay? So if you don't ask me to put back H bars and C's and Boltzmann constant of this one, even though may be obvious where they appear. So this is the quality factors, the ratio of the resonant frequency to the loss rate. And it tells you how, basically it tells you how good the resonator responds under resonance. Now, this Q for a cavity, for example, that Conrad cares about is the finesse. So it can come in different names depending on what a different resonator is. So now, let's find solutions of the system. Let's take that there is a force that has an amplitude F naught, and it has a frequency omega t, monochromatic. Let's try to find a solution, x of t. We know it has to oscillate at the same frequency, and see what we get. So, take this equation, take these instances, and we get omega squared, x naught e to the I omega t, plus I omega gamma e to the I omega t, plus omega naught squared, x naught, I forgot x naught here, omega t, e to the I omega t, is equal to f naught over m. Now, it's clear that the time dependence drops out. And from that, we can solve for the ratio of x naught over f naught. And we find that this goes like 1 over m 1 over omega squared plus omega naught squared plus gamma naught omega. This is known as the susceptibility of the system. And it essentially measures the response. So any system, the response of any harmonic oscillator-like system can be uniquely described by this quantity right here. Okay? And let's see what this says for the harmonic oscillator. So let's plot it. I can go low. Yeah, I'm sure. Okay, here. To make it bigger. So let's plot the absolute value of x naught over f naught and see what this does as a function of the driving frequency omega. So here we have the resonant frequency omega naught, and we get something that looks like this. So in the low frequency regime, the force, the response of the harmonic oscillator, its displacement versus the driving force of the harmonic oscillator, they are go like 1 over m omega naught squared, which is nothing else than Hooke's law. And x naught and f naught are completely in phase. Now, as you go to high frequencies, so of course on resonance, you get the maximum response. And this distance here is determined by omega naught over gamma, which is the Q factor of the system. So you know that on resonance, you have maximum response for the same force. As you go at higher frequencies, this response goes like omega to the minus 2. And this happens because essentially of decoupling. If I have a system whose characteristic frequency is, let's say, 1 hertz, if I apply a force on it on a megahertz, I don't expect it to move much because it doesn't have time to catch to move as fast as the very fast, the very fast oscillating force that I have. And exactly because of that, turns out that there is a phase lag of the response versus the force. So here, if you were to plot x naught, you would find its proportion to minus f naught. So there is a minus sign. So there is a pi phase difference at high frequencies, which at low, while at low frequencies, you have the opposite, you have things move completely in phase. Okay? Any questions so far? Okay, good. So a quantity, just to also make the connection a bit with circuits, because I think that Conrad maybe mentioned it a lot, and actually you heard talks by Alex Shushkov that were mentioning it. Another quantity that's useful to define is the impedance of a system. And for a harmonic oscillator, this is defined as this F naught is equal to Z of omega times the velocity of the system. So now I define, instead of my fundamental parameter being the displacement, I have the velocity of the harmonic oscillator. And so this is Z of omega, this impedance, this is susceptibility, this is impedance, is related by the following relation. It's 1 over I omega chi omega, okay? And for example, this is more relevant, as I said, in circuits, because this force now for a circuit is the voltage you apply, and the velocity of the field is the current, because the analog of the displacement for a circuit is the charge, okay? Good. Now, a relevant quantity for the system, this susceptibility carries more information about the system than just its response. It also tells you what is the average power lost per cycle in the system. And the way it does is the following. So what we want to calculate is the average energy lost in the system per cycle over one period. And taken from our dear friend Landau and Lifshitz, find that this is just x naught df dt, where now these are the real, so here we define x to be the real part of x naught e to the I omega t, and f to be again the real part of f naught e to the I omega t. Now, when you do that, you drop out in your average, you drop out the fast oscillating modes, you find that this goes like 1/2 omega, the imaginary part of chi omega, f naught squared. So you see here that the imaginary part of the susceptibility tells you about how lossy your system is. And in fact, the quality factor of the system, if you cannot really write gamma in the simple form, can be defined as the ratio of the energy stored in a harmonic oscillator during a period of time over the loss rate, okay? Over the energy lost in a cycle. And, okay. Good. So now this chi of omega, besides telling us how much power is lost per cycle, will also tell us about the noise of the system. And for that, we need to introduce correlators. So the way the spectral noise density for a force is defined is the correlator of the force that's applied at the oscillator at time t equals zero versus the time t. And it's the Fourier transform of some, let's call it S sub f, e to the I omega t, the omega. And for the position, we have x of omega is equal to x e to the omega t, the omega. Now, these two quantities are related given that x naught and f naught are related by this relation. So one can show that s of x over s of f is equal to the absolute value of the susceptibility squared. And another important thing is that for the position, if I take the correlator at t equals zero, x squared zero, gives me the RMS value for the harmonic oscillator. So if I do this, multiply with m omega naught squared, maybe a half here, 1/2. This is the average potential energy of the harmonic oscillator, okay? Yes? No, just the second part. So this thing here, sorry, I just wrote it. I'm bad at writing things. So this is the average potential energy. So this correlator calculated on itself at t equals zero gives you the RMS value of the energy stored, potential energy stored in the oscillator. Okay? Good. We know now, excuse me. Now let's take this harmonic oscillator and put it in a thermal bath. If we put it inside the thermal bath, we know from equipartition that we should have 1/2 kT of energy stored in the potential energy of the harmonic oscillator. So we know that the potential energy has to be equal in a thermal bath, 1/2 T, because there's a K here that I've put to 1, where T is the temperature of the system. So now you see where this is going, because now I can correlate these RMS fluctuations of my harmonic oscillator with a temperature. And, okay. Let me, where is the receiver? I'll take this. Oh God, what can I erase? I'll erase the references. And if you ask, it'll probably be in the screenshot. Okay. So now we know from these two equations that the average value of X naught is equal T over M omega naught squared. Now let's go back here and plug this guy in. So we get from here that the integral of the spectral noise density of the position for the harmonic oscillator has to be equal to T over omega naught squared. Now let's take it one step further and substitute with this relation right here. So from this we get that the integral over SF times chi naught squared the omega naught. And now we can make the following assumption. Now let's make the simplifying assumption that gamma is much less than omega naught. So this integral here is dominated with the region around the resonance. Is everyone with me here so far? Okay, good. Yeah, like gases, like you can have it in a gas, or it's in thermal equilibrium because it communicates through the spring with the environment. Yes, that's the force from the thermal bath, and we can discuss what it is eventually. This is what I'm trying to calculate.
And SX over F over SF is chi of omega.
Squared.
That's true basically for any omega, right?
Yeah, this is true for every type of noise, for everything that has, I should say, I didn't say it in the beginning, but the characteristic thing about the harmonic oscillator is that it's a linear response system. So if I have a force, the response of the system, which is the position, is linear in X. So any system that has this behavior can be characterized by this quantity. Okay, does that make sense?
Yeah,
thank you. Okay, thank you, Ita. So, now we can take this and calculate it on resonance. And you will see that you're dominated by the value of the noise on resonance times gamma. Then the imaginary part, there is this factor of 1 over M squared. Squared, omega naught squared, gamma squared, is equal to T over M omega naught squared. So you see here, this guy cancels out, this guy with this guy cancels out, this mass with this mass cancels out, and you get that the force, noise force on resonance, is T M lambda. Okay. Now, and basically this is the essence of this is the essence of the problem. Now, I've calculated this on resonance. Turns out that for the force, this is true at any frequency for the noise force. And I won't go into the details of the proof of the fluctuation dissipation theorem, but you may have seen in Alex Suskov's slides, he talked about Johnson noise. So for Johnson noise, the force needs to be substituted with the with a voltage, and the loss rate gamma is substituted by the resistance. So from that you see that the noise of the system, which is directly proportional to the temperature, the mass times the loss rate. For an electric circuit, this product is substituted by the resistance. Okay, so the lower the losses, that means the higher the Q, the lower the noise your system will have. Now, and this is a good time to say, so then why don't we try to build as high as Q as possible? A very important fact that I forgot to mention at the beginning is that all this applies in the steady state response of the system. So you know that if you have a harmonic oscillator, to start to drive it at T equals zero, it will take a time to run the pump to the full amplitude. That's set by the period times Q. So we need to wait for very long times for the system to respond as required. Now, as I said, this proof here can be extended for every frequency. And the way it's done, you take the excitations of the system and calculate how much energy dissipated, again, this quantity right here, in terms of the fundamental parameters of x naught squared, and you find that the general answer is that the noise force at any frequency now is given by 2t over omega, the imaginary part of the susceptibility, chi naught omega squared. And the position noise from this you can also get, and you find this goes like again 2t over omega, imaginary part of chi omega. So, so basically you see that the noise of a system is directly proportional to the energy lost per cycle, okay? So this is, so that means that you're correlating fluctuations with dissipation. Okay. Any questions? Okay, doing a great job this morning. Good. So now one can solve this precisely for the harmonic oscillator and find that this is equal to 4. Forgot the factor of 4 here because of my crude algebra. 4 times m gamma. And again, this is exactly analog to Johnson noise that you get for an electric circuit, for which the noise, so for a circuit, like circuit V, so S of V goes like 4TR. Okay. Now, this I've done at high temperatures. This has been can be extended to any regime, even in the quantum regime. And then you find that, let me see what I can erase now. I leave that there. I'll erase this. So if you go to the quantum regime, as t goes to zero, you find that 2t over omega needs to go to some funny cotangent of omega over 2t, which goes to 1 at zero temperature. Okay, yes, say you. Sorry? Oh, no, I cannot hear you. Sorry.
Yeah, 1 second.
K Boltzmann is 1. Sorry, sorry. Yes, K Boltzmann is 1. I'm deaf. Yeah, yeah. So KB is 1. Here, here, here. Yeah. Yeah, I'm a theorist. KB is 1. Now, although, so then when you do that and take the limit of t equals 0, this goes to 1, this cotangent. And when you integrate the noise for the position, you can recover that the 0 point fluctuation at t equals 0, I'll come to you, Itai, goes like 1 over omega naught, which is this, what we call the standard quantum limit for a harmonic oscillator. Yes?
Can you wait a second, Itai?
Yeah, sorry.
2t over omega, it goes to 0, goes to cotangent.
No. You need, as you take the quantum limit, so as you take the quantum limit and you take full quantum, because this is at high temperatures and I just have Boltzmann, okay? Mm-hmm. So if I go to very low temperatures where I have to take into account the 0 point fluctuations of the harmonic oscillator, then this t converts to a cotangent.
But then you get divergences whenever omega over 2t equals...
No, it's not. It actually behaves nicely.
Goes like t over omega. Divergence cancels with something
Yeah,
else?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So this goes to 1. You can do the check. It goes to 1. This cotangent goes to 1 as t goes to 0.
No, but I'm saying not t goes to 0. Let's say I have a cotangent function. So every time omega over 2t is going to be equal to pi over 2 plus pi n or something.
No, this goes to, at large values, this goes to this quantity right here. You can check. Can we do it afterwards?
Sorry, you mean the hyperbolic cotangent? Or just
hyperbolic cotangent.
Okay,
sorry. I did write cotan H, but I said cotangent, right? Sorry.
Oh, I missed the H. I thought it was part of the.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Yes. No, I did write
hyperbolic. Thank you.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry. Oh, God. Too early in the morning. Okay. So by integrating the zero temperature limit, you find that you recover what you would expect for the ascertaining the position of a harmonic oscillator. So all is good. Now let's make some general comments about this noise. There's another question? No. Okay. So let me erase this part here. So now let's talk about the force a bit. So we've talked to you, I've plotted you the response, which is essentially So one characteristic of the noise force for a harmonic oscillator in the thermal bath is that this is a constant. And if you do the Fourier transform, if you go back and calculate f of t, 0 of this constant e to the I omega t, the omega, you find that this is the constant times the delta function. So this type of noise is what people call white noise. It's independent of frequency, and it's proportional. This Fourier transform in time space, it's just a delta function. It tells you that the force at time 0 and time t equals epsilon, 0 plus epsilon, they're completely uncorrelated. Okay? Now, based on this, this is not the only type of noise response systems have. Now let's go to squids, okay? Squids, and this is something that Alex mentioned in his talk, at low frequencies, squids, they have a noise that goes like 1/f. And when you do the Fourier transform of this, which is, say, the voltage or the current in the squid, so the Fourier transform of this 1/f is basically is proportional to a constant. Okay? Now, so the way I've read, and Konrad can tell me where this is coming from, is the statement that, so this appears in squids, this 1/f, and it apparently comes from the fact that you can have, so squids are inserted. Eh? Yeah, 1/ω, sorry. Yeah, no. Omega, sorry, yes, thank you. So it happens in circuits a lot. This is something that people that deal with circuits deal with this all the time. And they believe it comes because charge carriers get stuck at random times as they move around in the circuit. And apparently this corresponds to this correlation to be some constant function. Talk to Konrad right before we came in. At some point for squids, so if you were to plot the noise for squids as a function of time of omega, you find you have 1/ω in the beginning, and then it goes to a constant. So for so where exactly this happens, they don't know. And it is true, but it tells you something that you guys should know, that many systems can exhibit more than one behavior of noise, okay? And I should say this is white noise, as we said before, and this is pink noise. Okay. Now there is another type of noise that people may be familiar with. Yeah. Oh yeah, sorry, yeah. Red noise? I'm pleading the fifth on this one. I have no idea what red noise.
Because the problem with 1/f noise is that when you integrate it, right, it's infinite. It's infinite.
Oh yeah. There is some yeah. But I'll. Yeah, but you always cut it off at some low frequency, right? So there is always some cutoff, and I'll talk about signal to noise ratio next. But okay, what did you want to say?
So you're saying you can do all this stuff, but you don't need like Parseval's theorem to hold.
No. You don't need to. Sorry, repeat what you said because I said no.
Because I feel like this is like assuming quantum mechanics, the probabilities add to one. You have this problem where your power is infinite with 1/f noise.
Yeah, but it goes, as Konrad said, it goes logarithmically. Yeah. You always have some natural cutoff.
Okay.
Yeah, and finite in time. This is what I was going to say, that when you do the signal to noise ratio, that you will see that you always integrate the noise over a finite region of time. So I'll come back to that later. And finally, this is the noise, right? The spectral noise density. This is what I'm plotting.
F itself would go like 1/ω. I might be wrong here. I don't
understand what you're saying here.
Okay, maybe I'm.
Let's talk about it later, sure. Because I really don't understand your question.
Sure.
So, now there is another one. There's a final noise that's relevant for physicists, and it's related to Brownian motion and random walks. And for that, the spectral noise density goes like 1/f omega squared. And you find then that the correlator in time, F of omega, goes like T. So if this is the position of a position in the gas molecules, it grows with time. Okay. As I said, systems can change their behavior. You can transition from one noise to the other, and it depends on the type of physics you have. But as we just discussed, the relevant thing for detection always involves some integral finite in time. So now we know the noise of our system, and now let's say I have a signal force on my harmonic oscillator. This can be anything from a new fifth force, or it can be a gravitational wave, like in the case that you have for LIGO. So how do you calculate the signal-to-noise ratio? Let's go here. Okay. Yeah. So the signal to noise ratio set by the amplitude of your signal, then let's assume that your signal is completely monochromatic. Over the integral of the spectral noise density over a range. And the question is, what sets that range, square root of this? So the question is, what sets that range? So if this signal is applied on some given frequency, omega equals omega signal, the range over which I integrate my noise, the noise that fits into my system, is between the omega range, goes from omega signal minus 2 pi over tau, omega signal plus 2 pi over tau. Where tau now is the duration. How long do I keep taking data for? And you can understand this from the uncertainty principle. If I observe for very short times, I cannot specify the frequency of my signal to very good accuracy. But as I integrate for longer and longer times, it means the uncertainty with which I can determine the frequency goes down. And this tells you that when you calculate the signal-to-noise ratio for a force in a harmonic oscillator, F signal, and we have the spectrum here, this is the noise. So this is the integral for a force, this noise is constant. And then you have 2 pi over tau to the 1/2, okay? 4 pi over tau to the 1/2. So this gives you that the ratio of your signal to your noise, you have 16 pi m gamma to the 1/2 times tau to the 1/2. So you see here that the signal to noise ratio grows with the square root of the time. Eventually, this will stop because no signal is completely monochromatic. Now you've heard for dark matter that the coherence time is 10 to the 6 periods. So you can integrate for tau times omega of roughly 10 to the 6 for the axion, for example. Now, if we put here signal to noise ratio of 1. Sorry, I forgot the T. Yeah, thank you. So when you equate the signal to noise ratio of 1, it gives you a figure of merit about the minimum force your harmonic oscillator can detect. And for that, where do I go? Have the susceptibility, where do I write? I leave this here. I'll just erase here. So f min is equal to 16 pi m gamma t divided by tau to the 1/2. Okay. Sometimes this tau, you will also see like expressed as the people call it sometimes the bandwidth of your, depending on the bandwidth that you integrate of your experiment. Yes? The inverse. Sorry. The inverse. Yes. Thank you. The inverse of that is the bandwidth of the, there's a factor of two. So now let's try to plug in. So now I'll replug. We're almost done. So now let's take some numbers and try to see why David's experiments or George's experiments or Marco's experiments are so great. So give me a mass. How much mass do you want to put? How much? 100 nanometer silicon sphere? Picogram, 10 to the minus 12? Okay, so let's say we have a mass of 10 to the minus 12. 100, you said 10 to the minus 10 kilograms. Okay, 10 to the minus 13, thank you. 10 to the minus 13 kilograms. Now give me a frequency. 100 kilohertz, 10 hertz. Okay, 10 hertz. Give me a Q.
You need the free running Q, which we usually don't run at, but probably 10 to the 7, 10 to the 8-ish.
Okay, let's be great and very 10 to
There's
the
a
8.
Subtlety we can talk about after that we damp the Q outside of the theorem.
Yeah. Let's take 10 to the 8. And temperature, 300, do you want to do it at room temperature?
For this Q, you need 300, yeah.
Okay.
This is the cold damping story we can talk about later.
Okay. And tau, let's say 10 to the 6 seconds. Like a day, a week, something. Okay, good. Okay, we're happy. Okay, for this one, I'll have to put kbt because if I do it in natural units, it's roughly 10 to the minus 30 C in SI units. So now the minimum force that this setup can detect is we have 16 pi. That's 3, let's call it 50. Now the mass is 10 to the minus 13. So gamma, I should say here, gamma is omega naught over Q. So we put here 10. So should I put a 2 pi? I'll just leave it 10 hertz, okay? 10, 300 here, and we have 10 to the 6, and then we have 10 to the 8, to the 1/2. So now, oh, and then I forgot, very important, 10 to the minus 23. Okay, I'm putting back my SI units, okay, for this one. So so this is 10 to the minus 36. So this is 10 to the 14. Minus 23, gonna be a bit slow here. Let's call this 3, 5, 10. 100 10 to the 4 times 10 to the minus 27 to the 1/2. It should be all Newton. So this is 10 to the minus, this is 50, 46. 10 to the minus 23 Newton I'm getting, guys. Your guys are doing pretty well.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's actually right for that low the frequency in 10 to 6 seconds.
Okay, we put very low frequency. Okay, so now you see why these guys are going after it. I mean, in his colloquium, Giorgio gave you a value of the force, a value of the force of gravity at 10 microns of 10 to minus 21. So that's why they're using this type of sensors. So they're extremely sensitive. Okay? And do we have more time? Okay, I have 5 minutes. But we are not done yet. So, oh, the other thing to notice, this noise is independent of frequency, right? Yes, yes, Ben?
I had a different question, which is, this seems like the appropriate analysis if you know the frequency that you're looking at, and so you can say your bandwidth is 1 over tau, but say you're doing a broadband experiment for which you can define a bandwidth that you're sensitive to that's different from 1 over tau.
Yeah.
How would you change this analysis?
I don't know.
Okay.
You will have to do, for example, you will have to do an optimization problem, and they have ways to do that, but I don't personally know.
Yeah, maybe I'll just comment that there is a solution, it's called the optimal filter, and I'd be happy to talk. You basically just divide the shape of your signal, do everything, but instead of a delta function for your signal, divide the shape of the signal frequency space.
Yeah, so I didn't want to talk about that because I cannot do it justice. So yeah, this optimal filtering thing, I read about it. Someone else can do it. I mean, it's a big deal. Like, for a theorist, when I calculate my sensitivity, I won't go into that detail, but in reality, and in fact, okay, there is, so when I were doing a recent paper with my student Amalia and Ken van Tilburg, we were reading about squids, and there is a tome from your colleagues at Stanford, from Kent Erwin, and a 200-page paper where they actually calculate the optimal filtering function for dark matter in an RLC circuit search. So you can understand why I didn't want to mention optimal filtering here, and I stuck to my very simple delta function.
I mean, you've done the optimal filter for a delta function signal.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. okay, so the other thing you will notice is that this minimum force that I'm talking about is independent of frequency. At every frequency I look at, no matter what, even if I'm on resonance or away from resonance, I'll get the same sensitivity of force. But then the question is, why do we use resonant detectors? And this has to do with the response of the system. So you go here, you see that for the same force, the response is maximized on resonance. So now, okay, I have my detector, it's feeling a force from an axion from whatever gravitational waves, I need to detect a response. And whatever I use to detect the response is not perfect. It will have its own noise. So that means now that you can imagine that there is a line that determines your detector sensing ability. And usually we draw it as a flat line. Whenever the response of the harmonic oscillator is above that flat line, it determines the frequencies that your detector is sensitive at. And in principle, if you had a perfect detector, a harmonic oscillator could be a broadband detector, could be sent in all range of frequencies, but that's in an ideal world. That never happens. So usually you need to optimize your setup at the frequencies where you're at. At resonant frequencies. So, which brings us to the final thing I want to say. And that has to do with how you detect the response. Okay? So, now this is the intrinsic noise of the setup, but we have. So, now let's say I have again my harmonic oscillator here, and now I'll erase this. And now let's say I'm taking a laser and I'm shining light on my harmonic oscillator. The light shines back, and I see the interference pattern on the light onto itself, like in a cavity, to measure the position of my harmonic oscillator. Now, the total noise in how well I can determine x of my harmonic oscillator is the sum of the Sx that we calculated before, plus the imprecision noise that tells you how well can your detector measure this position. Yeah, okay. And then there's some other stuff that I will just briefly comment on. So now, how well can we measure the position delta x? And I will do a back of the envelope now. We know, because this is an apparametric experiment, there is that factor of two that you will see. It depends on the accuracy at which I can determine the wavelength of the light I'm using. There's a factor of two because of the twice the path, divided by the number of square root of the number of photons that it takes to do the measurement, okay? So this is what is called delta x imprecision. And this is a characteristic of your signal. And you see, the more photons I use, the more precisely I can determine the position. But every time I do that, there is some uncertainty. I don't know how to use this. So there is some uncertainty. I imprint an uncertainty in the momentum because there is light bouncing off my oscillator. So this here goes like the wave number k of the photon. So it's, let's say, 2 times 1 over lambda times the square root of the number of photons. So the more photons I shine on my harmonic oscillator, try to measure it better, the more momentum uncertainty I imprint on it. So you see here that there is some type of uncertainty relation relating my ability to determine with a detector, external detector, the position of the harmonic oscillator, and the essentially force that that measurement imprints on the harmonic oscillator. So you see here that this delta x imprecision times delta p is of order 1. More formally, one can show that the noise from Sx imprecision times the back action, so, and this is some sort of force, they call it back action force, the square root of this has to be larger or equal to 1/2. So here I need to add another thing here. So, and this is what, so when you consider the full system, you have to take, so it's not just the fundamental noise, it's actually how well you can measure the signal. So you cannot use infinite precision because eventually you will back act on your detector. And a lot of these guys are trying to do, and if you heard quantum non-demolition, and I don't have time to talk about it, is how do you avoid this back action noise so you can measure something very, very precisely. And it's an entire different field. And with this, I will end and take your questions. Thank you.
Questions?
Could you explain again why the minimum force you can detect is not frequency dependent, but you still need the resonance to see something?
Yeah, so first of all, the fact that this frequency independent comes out from the properties of the harmonic oscillator and thermal bath. It's not just the thermal noise property, the white noise, okay? Just because I have white noise is flat noise, period. Now, look, let's look at this plot here. So this plot shows the response. So for a given constant force, let's say I have a constant force, constant amplitude, and I just change the frequency at which I apply it. You see that on the beginning I have something, the maximum response, the maximum displacement for a given force happens on resonance, okay? So that means that for me to be able to detect the signal very well, if I monitor the position of the force, like with light, I need to maximize the position response. So this is why you need the resonance. So in principle, if I had a perfect detector, if I have a detector that for this would be zero and this is zero, I would be limited basically by, I would measure a force, the same force, I would have the same frequency, the same sensitivity across all frequencies for a harmonic oscillator. But the fact that the way we are measuring is imperfect tells us that we need to maximize amplifier signals. So this is where the amplifiers come in, for example. You need to amplify your signal to be able to measure it. Okay? Does that make sense? Good.
Other questions? Let's thank you.